my sister's husband stood for Parliament here. And I went and did the campaign, really as his sort of campaign aide. I was his dog's body gopher. And what I discovered, which I rather regret it now, is that electoral politics is a drug.
You're listening to Humans of Politics, a podcast about how it feels to be a politician. My name is A.B. Philpin Bowman, and my guest today is an MP who resigned from the British Conservative Party to sit as a progressive independent Conservative, Nick Bowles.
And once you've got the bug, perhaps a drug or a bug, it's very hard to shake it.
When you describe it as a drug, I'm conscious you were part of what was called the Notting Hill set, this sort of generation of Conservatives that included David Cameron and George Osborne, Michael Gove, yourself. And I'm wondering, when Cameron came to power, was there a sort of almost an intoxicating sense of we've arrived and we're going to modernise the Conservative Party and reshape British politics? I mean, is that what it felt like?
Yes, I do think that one of the most sort of looking, you know, I'm not old, but nevertheless, this is probably the end of my political career rather than the middle. And I look back on it and I do think that one of the most exciting phases of politics is taking a party that's sort of flat on its back, that's lost touch with the people and lost touch with the modern world and the issues that people are worried about and the things that people think, and helping bring it back in touch and redefine it and reimagine it for a new age. I think that that process, which is obviously mostly done in opposition, is actually, in terms of creativity, probably one of the most creative phases in politics. For me, it was necessary because, funnily enough, when I left the Conservative Party earlier this year, a British journalist called Rod Liddell wrote in, I think, The Spectator magazine, "Oh, Nick Bowles was never a proper Tory." And, you know, people thought that I'd be rather insulted by it. And I remember thinking, no, not at all. He's absolutely right. I never really was a proper Tory. And in a sense, the changes that we made and that David Cameron then ultimately led were essential to make it even possible for me to imagine being at home in the Conservative Party. And it was only with those changes that I could feel comfortable there. And once the party started in the last couple of years, seemingly to reject some of those changes, at any rate, that it lost any sense of appeal for somebody. I mean, I am a soggy centrist, I'm afraid, and ultimately the party has gone back to the edge.
When you first ran for the Conservative Party, it was in the early 2000s, and you were openly gay. Talk to me about how you navigated the public and private dimension of that at a personal level.
Yes, it's definitely had defined the early years of my sort of tiptoeing gently into politics. There was a time when I was trying to get selected as a candidate in a safe Conservative seat in Somerset. It was for the 2001 election. And I had decided that I wasn't comfortable with the idea of not addressing the issue head on during the selection process, because I didn't want people to be able to say that they discovered afterwards and that I hadn't been straight, perhaps not the right word to use, that I hadn't been honest with them. And we had a big discussion among people who now are much more prominent than I have ever been, like David Cameron and George Osborne and Michael Gove. We talked as friends about how I should address it. Do I do it at the beginning of the speech or at the end of the speech, in answer to a question? How do I put it? And in one place, Bridgewater, I addressed it in the second round interview and just said, you know, you need to know this about me because it's not something I'm ashamed of, but it shouldn't bother you because it's a private matter and no reason why it should get in the way of my being able to be your candidate. Anyway, I got rejected at that round, and one of the people who'd been on the committee, the selection committee, decided, I think wrongly, that this was a product of bigotry, that they had rejected me despite the fact that I was better than other candidates because I'd declared that I was gay. And he unfortunately went to the local press, which also happened to be the local paper that my parents got at home and all their friends got.
I'm assuming it wasn't a shock to your parents. I mean, that was in the newspaper perhaps, but the news wasn't a shock to them.
No, they knew about the fact that it was something that they had got used to me dealing with sort of privately and personally with friends and family, but not making a big song and dance about it. And so to the front page of the local paper was perhaps not the place that they would have chosen to have read about it.
I think it was Noel Coward who said, you know, the little ladies come to see me know exactly who I am and what I am, but they don't need to hear all about it. They're comfortable, but they don't need to the details.
And my parents were of a generation where that was the best way of handling it.
Another factor that's out of your control, but that has intervened at key moments in your political career, is your health. Indeed, in one instance, your poor health gave Boris Johnson his big break in politics, and you know, the rest is history. What's it like when your political ambitions are derailed by your health?
I mean, definitely, it's a very good description. Derailing things will pull the rug out from under you. And yes, it's done it twice. It did it back in 2006 when I was sort of limbering up to have a run to be the Conservative candidate for Mayor of London. And in the end, when I pulled out because I got diagnosed with cancer, Boris Johnson put his name forward and took over, actually, the very small pot of campaign money that I'd raised and some of the people who were helping with me, and obviously went on to glorious victory. And then it happened again in 2016, quite soon after the referendum, and Theresa May took over as Prime Minister. I resigned then anyway because I wasn't a supporter of hers and felt that when David Cameron went, that it was a good time for me to step back. But it nevertheless does totally upend all of your planning. I have to say, I actually think it's a profoundly positive, it's not a positive experience, obviously, but the impact for me was very positive because it made me realise that the greasy pole was not really all that it was cracked up to be, and that, you know, that what mattered is, you know, what you did with the time that you had when you were feeling well. And so since then, I've probably been liberated to be a bit more independent-minded than I perhaps would have been if I hadn't been ill, when I probably would have carried on trying to, you know, elbow my way into the cabinet and onto a senior job. That sort of the hamster wheel aspect of politics, I think I broke free of really when I fell ill.
Interesting, that sense of mortality giving you a perspective. As Tom Lehrer, I think, was said, it's a humbling thought that when Mozart was my age, he had been dead for 3 years.
That's a great line. I hadn't heard that one.
What was the hardest thing about leaving the Tory party?
Actually, funnily enough, there wasn't anything very hard about leaving the Tory party. The actual moment of decision is hard, just because you've been in it for 20 years and you've been an MP for 10, or nearly 10, 9. So, you know, breaking any familiar ties is hard to sort of summon up the courage to do. But in reality, by the time I did it, the ties had already disappeared. And actually, it was just an overwhelming sense of relief that I had adjusted, as it were, my formal status to fit the reality of my actual relationship with the party. Now, of course, you know, there are, you know, some people in the party, well, some other MPs here and some people in the party in my local area who were sad and about it. But my view is, you know, I haven't died and nor have they. And, you know, if they want to be friends, we can be friends. There's therefore no, I don't see that there's any great emotional cost to it. And as I say, for me, it was a feeling that I'd given full realisation to a truth that probably I'd been suppressing for too long.
Your actual resignation came just after Theresa May's famous Brexit date of the 29th of March 2019 had been missed, and there was deadlock over where to go from there. And in a pretty dramatic speech in the House of Commons, you informed your Conservative colleagues that you were leaving, and you told them why.
I have given everything to an attempt to find a compromise that can take this country out of the European Union while maintaining our economic strength and our political cohesion. I accept I have failed. I have failed chiefly because my party refuses to compromise. I regret, therefore, to announce that I can no longer sit for this party.
Oh, Nick. Nick, don't go. Come on.
Watching you give that speech, it seemed to me that you felt a real sense of anger, frustration, disappointment in your own colleagues.
Yes.
Is that how you were feeling?
Yes, no, very much. I mean, at the particular moment, it was this sort of sense that people were just utterly unwilling to compromise. And the ironic position that I found myself in as a Conservative MP was that I'd won the support of the Labour Party, including the Labour front bench, some Liberal Democrats, the SNP, people and parties with whom I've had no prior, you know, relationship or understanding, and yet I couldn't get more than a tiny number of my own colleagues, many of whom I knew privately agreed with me, to back what was a very, you know, moderate, centre ground, middle of the road Brexit proposal, what we call Common Market 2.0, the idea that we should have stayed in the single market and in something pretty like the customs union. And so it was that sort of frustration at the lack of a willingness to compromise. To be fair to my colleagues, it's, I think, actually not so much a reflection on them as individuals. It's more a reflection on our system. And what I've realised is that the first-past-the-post electoral system that we have in this country, which has, you know, at least in theory, claims to provide strong, effective government. But what it actually does is it creates very rigid, inward-looking and unflexible governing parties and even also opposition parties. Whereas I think that in a system with a more proportional system of elections, parties are constantly trying to find common ground, seeing if they can find a compromise that everyone can live with, because that's the only way you get anything done at all. It's the only way you get into government, because every government is a combination of different parties with different traditions and different priorities. And so my frustration, though on the night I resigned, it was expressed as a frustration with the Conservative Party, and obviously that was my chief frustration. Actually, it's a deeper frustration with our political system. If you're the opposition, you oppose, and if you're the government, you support what the government's doing, and there the twain shall meet. And I hate it, I must say.
Many of your colleagues who've left on sort of similar grounds, some of them joined this new group Change UK, some of them joined the Lib Dems, some did both. You didn't. Why did it feel right for you to be, I think, Progressive Independent Conservative is the name you decided to adopt. But why did you go for that option?
Well, I guess there are two reasons. The first is that one of my main complaints about the Conservative Party is actually a complaint about traditional political parties that are controlled and run by small groups of very unrepresentative members and activists, rather than by people who are just thinking about the voters and what the voters, you know, believe in and care about and want to hear from you. And the idea of going out of the frying pan of the Tory party that's totally in hock to a very small group of unrepresentative, elderly and relatively well-heeled party members obsessed with hard Brexit or no-deal Brexit, to go out of that frying pan and into the fire of another party with its own members, with their own weird and wonderful ideas that are completely unrepresentative, just wasn't appealing to me at all. So I was interested in the idea of a new force in politics, and one that was not in hock to, as I say, a small unrepresentative membership. But the problem is, by the time I left the Tory party, Change UK, the independent group, had sort of, you know, risen and fallen and crashed and burned. And, you know, there are many of them my friends, and I admire their courage, but I do think they made some terrible mistakes. And they pretty much made it impossible for any other new force to gain any traction in this parliament I don't think it's necessarily over for all time. I think our old party structures are out of date and will be increasingly off-putting and unappealing to the voter. So I think it's quite possible that there will be a new force, but I will have left politics before it happens.
Is there anything in your personal life which informs your understanding of Brexit?
Long before I ever thought about going into politics, I was in business, and I, as a young man, aged 28, bought into, with some investors, a business off the Crumlin Road in the centre of Belfast. It was a manufacturing business called Robert J. Hall, and it used to manufacture paintbrushes. And it was a very old business. It had been in Belfast for a couple hundred years. And this was in 1995, so before the Good Friday Agreement. And we had the paintbrush factory in just off the Crumlin Road, and we had a little tiny factory by a lake in County Cavan in the Republic of Ireland. And they were a completely integrated business, so the management were in common. One of them manufactured paint rollers, the other manufactured paint brushes, but there was lots of stuff always going up and down the road. And also myself and my great friend and business partner, who also went up and down the road between the two. I didn't really think about it probably for 20 years, because we didn't find I was a particularly brilliant businessman, and we got out of that business about 5 or 10 years later. And it wasn't until very recently that I suddenly realised that, firstly, I had perhaps a better understanding of Ireland and the relationship and between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland than many MPs, certainly many English MPs. But secondly, that the famous open border was, as far as I can remember, completely open in 1995, you know, 2 years before the Good Friday Agreement. So the idea that this is just a product of the Good Friday or Belfast Agreement is clearly wrong, that there's been a much deeper sense of integration between the economies. For all that there were still, you know, I remember there was always stuff about fuel smuggling and, you know, different rates of tax on fuel. So, and those issues, you know, were true then, and no doubt there are still many of them now. But I think that it probably has made me perhaps more alert to what non-political people from both sides of the border in Ireland have said about the risks of carelessly introducing some administrative arrangement that you think seems totally harmless and bureaucratic, but which in that particular context could be used and abused and could end up, you know, taking one back down a slippery slope that, you know, the people of Ireland have just climbed laboriously up.
Finally then, is there a politician who you completely disagree with on Brexit but who you like or respect at a personal level?
Well, I mean, my closest friend in politics, certainly, and pretty much in life as well, is Michael Gove. And I'm godfather to his son, and we speak most days. And, you know, our friendship has had to weather some storms because of Brexit, and we've had moments where we found it hard to be friends, but actually it's got through sort of unscathed. And, you know, we have deeply, deeply different views about Brexit. Though, funnily enough, I think, weirdly, we may have slightly less... The differences might be slightly less stark now than they were in 2016, in that he, I think, privately can see that the liberation that he thought it promised is going to be much more constrained and attenuated by just the modern reality of the modern world. And I do feel that the position of the United Kingdom in the European Union was not a sustainable one. That the way in which the European Union works, and certainly the direction in which it is looking like it wants to develop and has developed over the last 10, 20 years, at some point it was going to break for us. And so, you know, maybe at some level we have a greater level of agreement just by having lived through it together, talked about it constantly, tried to understand each other. So it hasn't been impossible.
And when you leave here, what will you miss?
Very little. I have no natural affection for Parliament. I'm not somebody who likes its traditions. I don't like the architecture of the building. I don't like the mannerisms. I don't like the customs. I don't like the way people talk. I really don't like any of it. I do find fascinating, you know, the big issues, the big public issues of the day, and they are ultimately settled in Parliament, or at least particularly at the moment they're settled in Parliament. And so it's been completely fascinating to be here, particularly in the last couple of years, and I wouldn't change anything about having been here, but I will leave without a backward glance. You know, there will be no regrets.
Thanks for listening to Humans of Politics Season 2. If anything got you angry or got you thinking, all feedback is welcome. I am on Twitter as AB Philbin Bowman, at ABIEPB. Finally, you've probably noticed that we are living through a time when democracy itself is under attack and where political debate has become angry, distrustful, and hyper-partisan. And I'm not suggesting that we can single-handedly reverse that with podcasts, but if you think that conversations like this are a step in the right direction and you'd like more people to discover it, the easiest and cheapest thing you could do would be to leave us a nice review wherever you listen. Thanks again.